This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And we had a quiet night in Baltimore for once this week, largely quiet. And it will be very quiet and sad at that Baltimore Orioles makeup baseball game from Monday that will be played today in a stadium closed to the public. Nobody in the seats. The game closed to spectators because of this week's violence, but a curfew was lifted this morning. It's expected to stay in place for a week. Today, people were beginning to clean up in the worst-hit areas. There was that amazing viral video of the mom in the yellow shirt grabbing and slapping her son she recognized dressed in a black ski mask and pulling him out of a crowd of hooligan rioters. CBS News did a whole segment on it called Tough Love. We will talk about tough love for the tough streets of Baltimore and the black-white divides there with actor Wendell Pierce later this hour. Wendell Pierce from The Wire. He will reflect on his time playing a black cop in that HBO series. But when a city erupts, is there a way to chart how we got here? Doesn't take much to turn a thriving city into a collection of isolated enclaves, really. Some real estate map shenanigans, zoning manipulation here and there, gentrification, loss of industry, and the seething anger begins to grow. Joining us is Antero Pietola, who is a Baltimore Sun reporter for 35 years. He's the author of Not in My Neighborhood, How Bigotry Shaped a Great American City. Antero, welcome to The Takeaway.
Greetings from Baltimore, the city of the wire.
City of the wire, that's right. City of a lot more this week. How does bigotry shape a great American city? How do small moves in quiet sort of moments of racial hatred become what seems obvious now as we look at the rioting in the neighborhoods that are black, white, isolated enclaves?
Well, Baltimore's story is a long story. It is the story of many American cities, perhaps not in this type of rioting, but in the history of the city. In 1910, Baltimore became the first American city to require by city council ordinance that each residential block be segregated. That's one milepost. Then in the mid-1930s, the federal government redlines Baltimore and 238 other cities, and that will then guide lending patterns and begin the kind of deterioration of neighborhoods, first during the Great Depression and then Second World War. Baltimore is a very old city, narrow row houses, 14, 16 feet. So during the war, Baltimore's population reached 1.2 million in 1942. In 1968, when we had the previous riots after Martin Luther King's assassination, the city's population was 910,000. Today, it is about 620,000. So there are lots of systemic things that are happening here.
And as the retreat of the population has taken place, has the housing stock been abandoned, been improved? Have there been renovations in neighborhoods, or has it been pretty much left open and abandoned?
All of the above. There have been renovations, but in terms of the housing stock, it is antiquated. Much of it, tens of thousands of units are vacant and boarded up. There is no demand for that type of housing. 40 miles from here is Washington, D.C., I challenge anybody to find any boarded-up houses in D.C. There are no boarded-up houses in Anacostia. There is demand in Baltimore. There is very little demand. Instead, what we have, and this also played in the Freddie Gray incident, is an old housing stock that is poisoned with lead paint, and it has killed the housing resale market. Gray also was involved in a lawsuit in which he alleged that he had become poisoned with lead paint. So this is a major, major problem in Baltimore.
And how does police activity contribute to this? If they're left to basically face all of these problems, not to justify anything that police do, if everything falls on the cops, you're going to have these kinds of incidents. You're going to have violence because if nobody besides the cops are dealing with these social problems, that's going to be the point of just like there's violence in the schools. If it becomes a babysitting service for social problems, that's going to happen. That's going to deteriorate the schools as well.
Absolutely. And it's a problem on many, many fronts. For instance, a great not majority, but almost half of the police department does not even live in Baltimore City. The same for fire. So there is the sense in the communities, not only in black communities, but also in white communities, that the policemen and policewomen, they are outsiders.
And that's true also here in New York. You know, I take the subway to work sometimes. I have an early call here at the station. And, you know, I was noticing at 5 a.m. on the subway, even in New York, and I take the subway all the time, and this is never the case, except at 5 in the morning, it's all black. All black at 5 a.m. And that's this kind of sort of soft, subtle bigotry of who does what, when, and why. And you see that racial segregation even here in New York.
And you see it in Baltimore. I am from Finland originally, and when I ride on Baltimore subway and then in Washington, D.C., 40 miles from here on the same day, I have the sense that in Washington I'm in a totally different country. People look different. They behave different. They are dressed differently. Now, let me return to the demographics. I talked about the cities, the shrinking city. What is also very important, and this comes to play in this incident, is the fact that in the early years, after the 1968 riots and before that, it was white flight. That white flight in Baltimore has been stemmed, but there is a continuing outflow of middle-class blacks, and this is a very serious situation in a city like Baltimore, which really needs demand. It needs people occupying housing, people who are working in working life and are productive members of society.
Are these wheels in motion and can't be stopped, or what turns around a city like this? There's certainly is, you know, plenty of reason to think that Baltimore can change. It's visible. It's, you know, it's got sports teams. It's, you know, certainly a part of the American conversation.
Well, Freddie Gray came from an area that is now known as Sandtown Winchester. And there has been lots of Habitat of Humanity renovation there. And there was a thinking in the 1980s and 70s that perhaps by giving people a stake in a community, by providing them good housing, that would resolve some of the problems. Of course, in Sandtown, most of the people are unemployed, and that is the key thing in Baltimore, key consideration, key factor, is that people need jobs. And so there is a whole generation of angry black males who may not have had a steady job at all.
What industries left Baltimore, and are there any that could come back? It is a port city.
Well, Baltimore used to be a big manufacturing city. Bethlehem Steel, particularly during the war, there was 50,000 people worked in aircraft manufacturing. All that is gone. There's lots of service industry. Really the thriving poster child for Baltimore's recovery and new frontiers is Under Armour, which is headquartered in Baltimore. But, I mean, there really aren't that many domestic, homegrown businesses in Baltimore. For instance, one fact is that in 1968, when the previous riots were here, there were still some Fortune 500 companies that were headquartered in Baltimore. Today, Baltimore is a branch office town.
Hmm. I didn't realize that Under Armour was based in Baltimore. That's a very high-profile brand. People should know that. Antero, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Antero Pietola was a Baltimore Sun reporter for 35 years. He's the author of Not in My Neighborhood, How Bigotry Shaped a Great American City.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.